years ago, and we still have the exact same problems. You can begin to see that this is a human condition, not some kind of, oh, woe is us, look at our times. It's always been like this. The world has always been discombobulated, angry, violent. It's always been full of greed, hatred, and delusion, because it is an underlying tendency towards the human condition. So if you get too caught in looking at the world as it is, thinking, oh, this is terrible, it's got to be fixed, then you can get lost running in all directions, trying to find a safe place, a haven, some way to deal with all of this difficulty. What I think the Buddha realized was that if he was going to be free of the suffering connected to the human condition, he was going to have to release the thorn in his own heart. I cannot tell you, I cannot express how different the world looks to me now than it did when I was younger, in my 20s and 30s, when I was so angry. It's pretty much the same world. I mean, now, well, I can't use Trump because we have Biden now, but I don't know how much different that is. But still, let's just use Trump. There was Trump in the office last year or last time. And when I was in my earlier years, young adult years, it was Reagan. And he was like just whacking up everything. He was taking away all of our safety nets, and the whole world felt like it was falling apart. It's not so much this idea that we have to fix the outer world. What I think the Buddha realized is, if he took the thorn out of his own heart and he began to settle down, then how he moved in the world would change. I wish that we could all, in this larger framing, have less thorns in our heart. Because I believe if we had less thorns in our heart, the world would settle down. But as long as we keep the thorns in our hearts and trying to fix out there, we are going to be forever, 2,700 years from now, I can write a sutta and it will sound just like this. We can all sit here and write the sutta of our times. It will sound like this. And 2,700 years from now, somebody will sit in a teacher's chair and they'll say, this is what Thoré and the Victoria Insight Meditation Society said about life at that time. And it would sound just like what the Buddha said. Because this constant belief that the problem is outside of us and it needs to be fixed keeps us trapped in this, keeps this thorn lodged in our hearts. So the Buddha took out the thorn, and when he took out the thorn and he realized he settled down, he then went out in the midst of that same world and started teaching people how to take the thorn out. That's what he taught. He didn't teach people how to fix the outer world. In fact, Buddha said very little about the outer world that was going on. But there's a sutta where this is an example of how I believe the Buddha affected this outer world. So there was a Brahmin. And usually Brahmins did not come to ordain with the Buddha. They did not come to get instructions from him. They came to have a talk, you know, they listened to talks, but very few Brahmins were going to come and actually be a student of Buddha. And so this Brahmin came, and of course he came with his servant. Probably was a slave, but let's call him a servant, just so we can stay on a settled, kind of an easier level. Comes with a servant. And when he comes, he sits down in front of the Buddha and he says, I want to join and follow you. The Buddha said, great. He says, do whatever you want. He goes, well, I'm in charge, so you have to do whatever I want if you want to follow me. And the Brahmin said, of course. And so what about this guy? He said, well, he comes with me. It's like a package deal. The Buddha said, nope. He has to decide if he wants to come too. So if he wants to come, it's on his own. So, the Brahmin probably looked at the servant like, what do you choose? The servant's like, I want to go with him. A wise decision. So, they do whatever vows that the Buddha put them through in order for them to take vows, and the Buddha made sure that the Brahmin really wanted to do this. Be sure this is what you want to do. And the Buddha and the Brahmin's like, yes, this is what I want to do. So then the Buddha says, okay, to take their vows, and he goes, my first instruction is to wash his clothing, look after all of his stuff, fix his meals, wash his feet, take care of him. And the Brahmin is like, take care of him? He's like the serpent. The Buddha says, well, that's my instructions. You got to take care of him. Wash his clothes, look after him. Of course, the servant is like, when did that happen? It's like, you got to look after him. Brahmin cannot do that. He just cannot do that. Cannot. So he tells the Buddha, I'm sorry. I cannot do that. We got to go. So he gets up and he tells the servant, let's go. Servant's getting up. He's like, This is his choice. Just like he had the choice to join, he has the choice on whether he's going to leave. So the Buddha looks at the servant and says, do you want to stay? Do you want to go? And the servant is like, I want to stay. So the Brahmin left and the servant stayed and continued to be this disciple of the Buddha's. Because in that moment, it's not like the Buddha changed the world, made any comments about the world, deal with the world. But what he did was he acknowledged that that servant had been taking care of that Brahmin for so long that the Brahmin needed to have his ego put in check. And I don't think the Brahmin realized that. But even after he made the choice that says, I'm leaving, he did not take away the choice that the servant had from the beginning. This is sort of what it is that we are embarking upon. This is what we're kind of moving our way towards. And I think there's another sutta that it really, so these suttas that I've been pointing to all weekend, we're going to have on the resource page. So you don't have to worry about writing them all down. But the sutta I'm about to read some of it, this is the way that we actually learn to be square in the present moment without whether we know how the present moment's going to unfold. So the Buddha, in the moment that he was with that servant and that Brahmin, didn't know, I'm sure. He may have had some suspicions that this Brahmin is not going to want to stay. But the Brahmin could have said, yes, I'm following your instructions. If that's what you think I need to do, that's what I'm going to do. He could have done that. But he didn't. And the servant could have said, I'd love to stay with you. I really think you can teach me a lot, but I'm really beholden to this man here, so I'm going to have to go. He could have done that. It's not what happened. I don't think Buddha was worried one way or the other, because what the Buddha had done by taking out this thorn is he wasn't letting the world dictate how he was going to be. He had deciphered for himself how he was going to be. That's what I think this sutta is about. So the sutta is about effacement. And a group of monks get together with the Buddha to ask him about effacement and what effacement is. And this is why, this sutta is why I believe that the reason we practice is to learn to be sensitive to suffering, to learn to be sensitive to harm. And so he is sharing, he's sharing some possible ways. He says there are 8 ways that people could think they have effacement. Effacement is the diminishing or the rubbing away of something such that it becomes insignificant. So you're shaving off enticement or attachment to the point where something is insignificant, or in this case, that you are shaving off the self to the point where you're not so concerned about how you are treated, what your ego is. He says, as to various views that arise in the world associated either with doctrines of self or doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to which those views arise, which they underlie, and which they are exercised upon, is seeing it as it actually is with proper wisdom, this, thus, the wisdom being, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then the abandoning and the relinquishing of those views comes about. So what he is basically saying is that in his training, the idea, when you take out this thorn, you're taking out this notion that you are the center of the universe, that everything centers around you and you alone, and you're taking it out, and you stop having all this agitated mind. So he lists 8 ways in which people think they have come to that understanding. And I won't read the details of them, but he says one of the ways is people get secluded from sense pleasures and they enter jhana states. So they enter, they can get to jhana, and they'll think, ah, I've clearly attained effacement because I don't have any more pleasure stuff. I'm tucked in, secluded, into a mountain cave, and I am in jhana, just bliss. But the Buddha said that this so-called pleasant abiding here and now, is not, that is not effacement. That's not what he's talking about. So he says that there's also a place where somebody can think that they have they have this applied thought, this stillness of mind, that they are in deep states of rapture and concentration. Not just, I just reached jhana, but I am deeply in concentration. And they'll think, oh, yes, clearly now. I have rubbed out the self. He would say, nope. That I am abiding in this again, this pleasant abiding, who has the pleasant, the one who has pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. Nope. They think, they may think that this is abiding in effacement, but they would be wrong. So then he says there's still other people who think that they also have the, they've abandoned all the sense pleasures, they're into jhana, they have this level of equanimity and they're still, and they don't have any pain, nor, they have no unpleasant, no pleasant, neither pain, neither pleasure nor unpleasant. And they're like, surely now, I'm almost walking on water here, surely now I have reached a level of effacement and I have eliminated the self. He says, nope. You would think so, but nope. They're not abiding in effacement. And he goes on through these 8 stages of deep concentration and stillness. So I remember, I don't know if you're like me, but when I first started practicing, I would see people who were like deep practitioners. And I would think, that is what this is all about. It's got to be the deep stillness and concentration that comes with practice. That's got to be what it's about. And Buddha is saying, I don't really care how peaceful you can get. I don't really care how concentrated you can get. That is not going to eliminate or eradicate or diminish your sense of self. So then he said, if you want to know how to do effacement, this is it. And he lists 44. You know how he is. Very complicated. 44 vows that you take in order to have this sense of effacement. So I will read some of them to you. They will be familiar. So he says, it's the way he says it that makes it significant. He says, others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. Effacement should be practiced this way. Others will kill living beings. We shall abstain from killing living beings. Here, effacement should be practiced this way. Others will take what is not given. We shall abstain from taking what is not given. Here, effacement should be practiced this way. You can see we're going through the precepts here. Others will be uncelibate. Okay, but we are late. We shall be celibate here. We shall not do sexual misconduct here. Effacement should be practiced this way. Others shall speak falsehoods. We shall abstain from false speech here. And he goes on to say, others will speak maliciously. We shall abstain from speaking malicious here. Others will speak harshly. Then he goes through a whole line of right speech. They speak harshly. People will gossip. People will be covetous. People will speak maliciously, falsely, harshly, gossip. We will not do any of that here. Then he goes through this line that continues on this idea of being harmful. They will be covetous, want other people's stuff. They will have ill will. They will have wrong view. And now we're getting into the Eightfold Path. They will have wrong view. They will have wrong intention. They will have wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort. They will have wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration. We shall not have all of that here. Then he goes through a whole section around people's behavior. They will have wrong knowledge. They will have wrong deliverance. They will overcome sloth and torpor. Others will be restless. Others will be doubtful. These are all the five hindrances. See how this is really the practice you've already been doing. Others will be angry. We shall not be angry here. Others will be resentful. We shall not be resentful here. Others will be contemptuous. We will not be contemptuous here. Others will be insolent. We will not be that way. Others will be envious. Fraudulent, deceitful, obstinate, arrogant, difficult to admonish. We'll have bad friends. We'll be negligent, faithless, shameless, have no fear of wrongdoing. We shall have fear of wrongdoing here. Others will be of little learning. We shall have great learning here. And then the last few, others will be lazy. We will be energetic. Others will be unmindful. We shall be established in mindfulness here. Others will lack wisdom. We will possess wisdom here. Others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. We shall not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously. We shall relinquish them easily, and thus effacement should be practiced this way. These 44 things When I first saw this list, I thought that, again, like with Rahula, that's way more than I can do. But mostly you have been practicing already with every single one of these 44. What I realized by this sutta, the reason why I wanted it to be a part of the resources, is that it's the vowing that this is. It's the setting the right intention by making this kind of vow to myself that I will not be this way here. Meaning in any given moment, if I'm feeling very arrogant, I will let go of that arrogance just so that I will not be arrogant here. This is how I begin to learn to turn the dial towards northbound. So then he goes through a long list in the sutta about that it's the inclination of the mind to basically be that the inclination, he says, I say that even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states of great benefit, so that one should be bodily and verbal, so what should be said of bodily and verbal acts conforming to such states of mind? So it's like, oh, I want to have states of mind that would incline me towards these 44, right? You think, how do I cultivate the kind of mind that would incline towards these 44? And then he lists the 44 all over again. A mind should be inclined thus. Others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. And you go through the whole 44. That's how you get an altruistic mind as such. You incline your mind that way. He says, well, okay. Just as unwholesome states lead downward and all wholesome states lead upward, then a person given to cruelty has non-cruelty to lead them upwards. So what he's saying is, and he goes through each one of the 44, if you are inclined towards killing other people, being inclined not to kill other people here, it's going to lead you upward. So then we say, okay. This is how we're going to practice. We're going to incline our minds by constantly thinking on these things. And we're going to move in that direction by allowing our tendency towards one way to be overcome by the tendency of its opposite. And he says, finally, that one who is himself or herself, their self, sinking in the mud, should pull out another who is sinking in the mud, is one who themselves is sinking in the mud, should pull out another who is sinking in the mud, is impossible. So that idea is impossible. That one who is himself sinking in the mud should pull out another one who is sinking in the mud. This does not make any sense. Oh, that one who is not themselves sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is possible. So he is that one who is himself untamed, undisciplined, with defilements unextinguished, should train another and discipline that person and help that person extinguish their defilements. That's impossible. But that one who is themselves tamed, disciplined, with defilements extinguished, should train another and discipline another and help them extinguish their defilements. So what he's saying is, in this last look at the 44, is you cannot help someone abandon their own cruelty unless you face your own. You have to face your own cruelty and accept your own behaviors for cruelty such that you can face another and help them face theirs. And if you go through these 44 each one and begin to extinguish it from your own life, then you can look at another person. It's sort of like the saying, you can't take the thorn out of another's eye when there's a log in your own. It's the same kind of way of looking at it, that once you have come to terms with your own cruelty, then seeing the cruelty of another, you could actually help them extinguish that cruelty. But if you haven't looked at your own cruelty, or you think you don't have any cruelty, then your attempts at trying to judge or extinguish the cruelty of another, not going to happen. You're just wasting your time. So this is a significant sutta, this sutta on effacement. But when you're thinking about right intention, looking at the 44 and seeing these 44 as vows that you take and set in motion that you will eventually see their coming into fruition. You will see your own cruelty and you will learn to abandon that. You will see your own harm and you will learn to abandon that. You will be able to see the harm and cruelty of another, but having extinguished it from yourself, you will be able to extinguish it and help other people extinguish theirs also. We cannot do that, though, if we don't look squarely in the mirror at ourselves in these 44 kinds of ways. And then lastly, when you look at this sutra and you begin to contemplate it, what you're going to notice is that all of it has to do with harm. All of it has to do with harm in some degree. And the more you align with those 44, the less harm you actually cause. So I'm going to end my time here. I know we'll take some questions with a poem. I may have read this. Oh no, I'm going to end it with the one that Brock gave me. He found it. That's right. He found this. It's a quote from Ajahn Chah. It's perfect. It's called The Wrong Road. Since we've been on the road all this time. This is what Chah says. If you don't understand the truth of suffering and how to get rid of it, all the factors of the path will be wrong. So wrong speech and action and wrong practice of concentration. It would be like wanting to travel to a certain village. You make a mistake and take the wrong turn. But you find it comfortable to travel on, and so you continue walking in the wrong direction. No matter how comfortable and convenient the road may be, however, it won't take you to where you want to go. So that's in a way what we want to begin to notice, but I think I do have to end on my poem. I like that. But William Stadsford's poem, The Way It is the perfect way to end, I think. This is what he says. There is a thread you follow. That thread is our right intention. This intention that we set in the heart. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing, and you have to explain the thread. But it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you don't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die. And you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You just don't ever let go of the thread. Let's sit with that.